Now, if you're not already out of bed, maybe this will help you.
Wake up! Wake up, wake up, wake up! Up you wake, up you wake, up you wake, up you wake! This is Mr. Senior Love Daddy, your voice...
Samuel Jackson in the movie Do the Right Thing with quite a wake-up call. Maybe Renee and I should try that. But if you still feel sluggish and drowsy after you're up, do not blame us because it could be the quality of your sleep. New technology devices are available now, all claiming to help improve your sleep and your health. Rich Jaroslawski has been reviewing them for Bloomberg News. He's a technology columnist there, and he talked with Renee about those technologies.
Welcome to the program, and I'm going to start by saying, are you like everybody else? I mean, do you have sleep problems?
I think I am. In my case, I can get to sleep, but I never get enough sleep. And I think millions of Americans feel the same way.
So let's talk about these new devices. What are they supposed to do? What magic are they supposed to deliver?
Well, they take advantage of all the technology that already surrounds us, whether it's our smartphones or our personal computers. And what they're trying to do is measure how well we sleep and how long we sleep. The idea being that if it's something that we can track, we can improve by adopting healthier habits.
I have a couple of these devices sitting here with me on the table. And one of them is called Sleep Tracker. And it looks like a big watch. It looks like almost an underwater watch. And what it promises to do is to help you wake up at the ideal moment in your sleep cycle.
Exactly. The idea is if you wake up from a deep sleep, you're going to feel groggy. So what you do with these devices is that you give them a time that you say, I want to wake up by 6:45, for example. And because they're monitoring your sleep cycles while you're asleep, they will look for a time in the window 15 minutes or 20 minutes before that set alarm time where you're in a light sleep phase where you are more likely to wake up refreshed.
Right. So you have to put a device, though, on your wrist. There's another one here you put on your forehead, sort of like a sweatband with something stuck to it on the front. Tell us about this one.
This is the Zio. And what you're seeing here, there's a device that's about the size of a money clip, and the sensor is in that. And it's attached to this headband that you put on, which makes you look pretty ridiculous.
Yeah, this one will keep your partner up all night.
Well, it certainly, I don't know that you want to look in the mirror when you're wearing this one. And you wear it over your forehead. So it's detecting things like the electrical impulses in your brain, your eye movements, and it's capturing all this data. And then it will wirelessly transmit it to your phone where there's a free app that Zio provides that will allow you to track of what kind of sleep, whether it's REM sleep, how much deep sleep you've had, how many times you awaken during the night. And all those things go into calculating the quality of your sleep. And the idea is if you can track it and quantify it, you can improve it.
Now, none of these technologies are very streamlined, and certainly none of them are invisible. What, though, might they tell us about what we might see down the road?
The really significant thing about these things is what they augur for the future. They are all part of a trend called connected health and another trend called wearable technology. So you can imagine when one of these things might be shrunk down to the size of a button on your pajamas that is wirelessly communicating with a mobile device that's plugged in next to the bed, providing you with much better data and much more data and allowing you to share that data wirelessly with a doctor or healthcare provider. So you can kind of see where this is all going. But the fact is we're right now at such an early, early stage that some of these things can be a little bit clunky. You really got to be dedicated if you're going to wear a headband to bed every night.
Rich Jaroslawski is technology columnist for Bloomberg News and a regular guest on our program. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Now, one provision of President Obama's health care law has become the focus of intense debate. Catholic bishops say they still oppose a requirement that most employers fully cover contraception in their health care plans. They oppose it even after President Obama widened an exception for religious employers on Friday. But while the bishops remain opposed, it is not hard to find parishioners who feel differently, as NPR's Allison Keyes reports.
Maria Berger's blonde hair whipped in the freezing wind outside the 10 a.m. Mass at Shrine of the Sacred Heart Church in Northwest Washington yesterday, saying that the church's directives are meant to be in people's best interest, but
the reality of practice, it rarely intersects.
No one who agreed to talk took the bishop's side. Like Berger, those who did talk think people are selectively following the bishop's rules. She quotes recent studies which say that 98% of Catholic women have used contraceptives.
The edicts are not being followed, and I think the public is doing what it will.
Berger says she doesn't like the way the church injects itself into political debates.
These people feel that they need to enforce whatever it is that they need to enforce, but in terms of public practice and in terms of public health, I'm more in favor of accessibility to contraception, however it may be.
I think that the bishops are really placing their energy in the wrong place.
Julie Martinez-Ortega says if one looks around the pews in this extremely diverse, very pretty church, it seems clear that most Catholics don't agree with the bishop's view.
Well, you can just, you know, count how many people in the pews have more than two or three kids with them. In fact, I think most of us here have one or two at most. So you could sort of, you know, infer from that what you may.
Martinez-Ortega says she'd like to see the church focusing more on fighting the death penalty at the national level or offering financial support to the unemployed. And she says if the Catholic Church is an employer, it should act like one. She notes other employers aren't allowed to use race or religion to discriminate, and she doesn't think the church should either.
We can't let the people who happen to work for Catholic institutions, especially those who aren't Catholic themselves, have to not get care that they would that they need to have in order to be able to have healthy, fulfilling lives.
Parishioner James McKelly says both sides in this debate blew it.
It was just a disaster of messaging on both sides.
The self-described liberal Catholic says both religious freedom and women's rights are important to him, but he calls this a battle that nobody won.
The Obama administration lost a ton of credibility, and the Catholic Church looked ridiculous in a lot of ways.
Mastelli says it's another misstep from an administration that got strong support from young progressives and 54% of the Catholic vote in 2008.
He frustrated a constituency that's very set in its ways and probably needs their hands held every so often.
At his side, Shana Corey echoed others here who are frustrated by what they describe as messaging blunders by the Obama administration, but say they still intend to vote for him this fall.
I'll choose the lesser of two evils, maybe.
Several of the parishioners here said this single issue isn't enough to affect their choice in November. Allison Keyes, NPR News, Washington.
So it's not hard to find Catholics, at least at that church, who differ with the bishops. Surveys have shown that something around half of Catholics agree with the bishops and something around half do not. After the president offered his accommodation on Friday, the bishops initially hinted at a positive reaction before announcing their total opposition.
It's Weekends and All Things Considered from NPR News. I'm Guy Raz. In 1933, Senator Henry D. Hatfield, a Republican from West Virginia, wrote a letter to a friend complaining about President Franklin Roosevelt.
This is despotism. This is tyranny. This is the annihilation of liberty. The ordinary American is thus reduced to the status of a robot. The president has not merely signed the death warrant of capitalism, but has ordained the mutilation of the Constitution unless the friends of liberty, regardless of party, band themselves together to regain their lost freedom.
When Sally Denton came across that letter, it sounded amazingly contemporary. So she dug further and came across a whole series of attacks and even plots against FDR. She's written about it in a new book called The Plots Against the President. And the story begins just weeks before Roosevelt's inauguration in 1933. It was one of the darkest moments of the Depression, and many people in America were calling for a dictator to get the country back on track.
Unemployment is skyrocketing. The country is rocking precariously, economically, in all ways. And it's hard for us today to realize that in 1933, that the country was reeling. There were suggestions that capitalism was not working, that democracy was not working. Various intellectuals, and I mean not crackpots, were really considering the possibility of fascism, of communism, of socialism, of Nazism. The whole country was in play.
We often hear about the times just before President Kennedy was killed and how he was really vilified by his opponents. And some people suggest that that is what led to his assassination, that climate. You describe an almost similar climate in the early 1930s, 1933, that surrounded Roosevelt. Talk about some of the people who were sort of vitriolically opposed to him and what they said about him.
As I was writing this book, sometimes I felt like I could close my eyes and just transpose, you know, modern day vitriol to what was happening. There was this sense that Roosevelt was radically changing the relationship between the government and the governed. And there was great fear about that in many quarters, both the right and the left. So you had these enemies like Father Coughlin on the right, who was concerned that he was becoming a communist, a tool of Jewish moneyed interests. Then Huey Long on the left, who thought that he wasn't going far enough to redistribute the wealth. And then you had, you know, right-wing reactionary veterans organizations. You had Wall Street interests.
It's interesting because there was really genuinely a conspiracy at a certain point to overthrow the Roosevelt administration, to replace it with a kind of a crypto-fascist movement. And this was the people behind it were mostly financiers, bankers, part of a group called the American Liberty League. Who were they?
Well, they were some of the wealthiest people in America. I think the handful of people that were really behind the Liberty League controlled assets worth more than $40 billion.
They thought he was a socialist or even worse.
They thought he was a socialist. I don't know. A lot of times it was unclear whether or not they were able to even distinguish between what a socialist was or a communist. Or there was just this sense that he was upsetting the status quo.
These bankers were behind something that became known as the Wall Street Putsch. What was their plan?
They thought that they could convince Roosevelt, because he was of their of the patrician class, they thought that they could convince Roosevelt to relinquish power to basically a fascist military-type government. It was a cockamamie concept. And the fact that it even got as far as it did is pretty shocking.
How far did it get?
It got far enough so that they had had at least $3 million invested and claimed to have up to $300 million at the ready. They appealed to a retired general, to lead it. And had he been a different kind of person, it might have gone a lot further. But he saw it as treason and reported it to Congress.
There are elements and themes in this book that seem almost to have been ripped from today's headlines. You know, talking about President Roosevelt as a part of a Jewish conspiracy, it sort of makes you think about the birther movement and whether President Obama was born overseas or if he's a crypto-Muslim. And did that occur to you as you were writing this?
Oh, absolutely. It was stunning to me that all these kind of paramilitary organizations and trying to prove basically that he was not one of us. I mean, this whole fear of the other and the demonization of Roosevelt has so many parallels to what's been going on in the country with Obama. And he was of Dutch Huguenot ancestry, and they were trying to prove that he was Jewish, trying to trace his bloodlines. You know, it seems to me that going through history here, there are times that we need to have a demon, somebody that's not of us, in order to solidify our fears and our anxieties. And I don't know what that is in the impulse of the American body politic, but the fact that this is 75 years later and some of these same impulses are continue.
That's author Sally Denton. Her new book is called The Plots Against the President, President Roosevelt, of course. Thanks so much for joining me, Sally.
Thank you.
It's Morning Edition from NPR News. Good morning. I'm Steve Inskeep. Today in Your Health, we plunge into energy drinks after we take a look at fiber, which is in almost every aisle of the grocery store. Food manufacturers are putting fiber into foods where you would not expect to find it, hoping to make their products look more healthful, which raises the question, are they actually more healthful? Amy Stan in a member station KQED went to find out.
I'm standing here at the grocery store, and I'm facing this wall of really sugary kid cereals. And a lot of them have this label on it. It says, good source of fiber. Which, if you think about it, may say more about us, the shoppers, than it does about what's in this box.
We're looking for elements within things. Almost a mystical kind of thinking.
John Swartzberg is a professor of public health at the University of California, Berkeley, and he believes that mankind's love affair with food additives, for example, fiber, can be traced back to a single moment in history, British Navy, 1747.
Well, they realized that when the sailors were eating citrus fruits, they didn't get this terrible disease called scurvy.
You may have heard this story. A Scottish surgeon named James Lind started giving sailors limes, found that scurvy virtually disappeared.
That's how the English sailors got the name limeys.
This launched the idea that specific isolated ingredients in foods could prevent, sometimes even cure, diseases. And often they could. Vitamin D prevented rickets. Iron prevented goiters.
So all of these things led us to think that, well, we just have to find these magic bullets within foods that we replace and will be much better.
And the legacy of this, says Swartzberg, is on full display at any modern grocery store.
Well, we can start with, like, breakfast cereal.
With me shopping was Jan Matsuno. She's a food scientist for the Center for Culinary Development, a research firm in San Francisco. Matsuno has watched the trends come and go. The low carbs, the omega-3s. She says what's enabled the fiber craze is, in part, chemistry.
It's very interesting. You can get these powdered, soluble fibers, and you put them into a glass of water, and it just dissolves, and it looks and tastes exactly like water. It's amazing.
Take white bread.
Yeah, so here, good source of fiber.
Matsuno reads off the list of ingredients.
Sugarcane fiber, oat fiber, a resistant cornstarch also can be fiber.
All, just to be clear, additives that you would not normally find in white bread.
So what does it bring the fiber up to here? Again, 3 grams.
In the world of food labeling, 3 grams of fiber is kind of a magic number. It's the minimum amount that you can pack into a product and still have the words good source of fiber on the label. But that designation, says Matsuno, is a little bit generous.
An apple with the peel is 5 grams of fiber.
The bigger question here is whether these fiber-fortified foods are making you any healthier. And this turns out to be one of those places where scientists know a lot less than you may think they do. For example, a lot of people think that fiber will help protect you against colon cancer. But so far, that link is not conclusive. There's a stronger connection between fiber and cardiovascular disease. Again, John Swartzberg from UC Berkeley.
There's a lot of data on fiber that suggests that, yeah, there may be less cardiovascular disease in people who eat a high-fiber diet.
In other words, people who eat lots of fruits, vegetables, and legumes have lower rates of heart disease. But no one knows exactly why this is. Why do fiber-rich foods appear to prevent heart disease? Is it the fiber, or is it something else in those foods? Maybe it's a combination of things. Maybe there is no single magic bullet. And so you have to ask.
If we're not sure what it is in fruits and vegetables, then as opposed to saying, well, it's probably the fiber or it's probably this or that, why not just have people eat lots of fruits and vegetables?
Now, some food scientists are less critical of these fiber additives. They say many Americans are always going to choose junk food over fruits and vegetables, so you might as well put some fiber in there, even if we don't really know how much benefit it's having. But what pretty much everyone agrees is this. Given a choice between fiber-fortified sugar cereal and an apple, you're better off with the apple.
I don't want people to think that by adding things to unhealthy foods, it somehow makes them healthy. And I think that's the most important message.
One thing we do know about some synthetic fiber additives, too much of them can give you gas. But don't expect to see that mentioned on the front of your cereal box. For NPR News, I'm Amy Standen.
It's Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm Steve Inskeep. Even as Greek lawmakers approved another round of austerity, Greek protesters registered their dissent over the weekend. The bailout package is part of an effort by creditors to save Greece from default and a possible exit from the euro. European leaders now need to sign off on the deal, but many people are beginning to wonder if saving Greece is possible. Greeks themselves say austerity is killing them. Joanna Kakissis reports from Athens.
Speakers blasted protest songs from the 1970s as street vendors sold souvlaki in the square across from Parliament. Many here were ready to fight, like Risa Kastrinou. She punched her fist in the air as she walked by the big beige Parliament building. Lawmakers were inside preparing to pass austerity measures needed to get $172 billion in bailout loans.
I've been unemployed for 4 years. Where can we find work? Look around. There's hunger, hunger, hunger. Our rents are going up along with everything else. I mean, where is this all going to lead?
She and other protesters are jaded by what they see as the failure of the previous bailout in 2010. It had also come with sacrifices. People's salaries and pensions were cut, their tax bills increased, and the recession deepened. Now more than 20% of Greeks are out of work, and half say they can't pay their mortgages. And now they're being asked to sacrifice again. That frustration led tens of thousands of them to the streets of Athens and other cities. The largely peaceful protests were marred by angry gangs who fought with riot police. Officers responded with volleys of tear gas. A woman sprayed people with liquid Maalox, the stomach antacid, to counteract the effects of the gas. Just know that it doesn't matter how many chemicals you throw at us, she yelled through a megaphone. We're not going anywhere. But the tear gas was too strong. A crowd of protesters rushed into the Amalia Hotel nearby to seek refuge. They huddled in the lobby, their faces chalky white from the Maalox, their eyes red and watery. One was Haran Nika, a high school literature teacher. The last austerity measures cut her salary. She's worried that the new cuts in the minimum wage will mean her teenage daughter will work for practically nothing. She says she's furious that some Europeans call Greeks lazy for wanting to have a decent life.
No, we don't all share responsibility for this mess. I mean, why should I feel bad for just wanting to live with dignity? With a job that pays enough so I can go on a summer trip for 5 days. At this rate, we'll actually be saying, thank God, I have something to eat today.
Another protester, Ioana Stambelou, says she's stunned by how quickly living standards have dropped in Greece. She works as a food researcher in the Netherlands. She wants Greece to keep the euro, but she worries that austerity will price her family out of basic services.
Well, I don't know how it will be. Most important is that everybody can be living comfortable and having, a hospital, a school, everything that, every member of the European community can be having.
Prime Minister Loukas Papadimos says that's not true. He says Greece is suffering because it lived beyond its means. He told Parliament that the new bailout, as well as a separate bond swap deal to cut Greek debt by at least 50%, will help the country regain its footing. Implementing this new program, he said, along with the loan support and the restructuring of our debt, will reduce uncertainty and increase faith in the Greek economy. But faith in Greece is shaky these days, especially after yesterday's violence. Rioters looted scores of shops and burned dozens of buildings, including a beloved neoclassical cinema house. European Union leaders are expected to finalize the bailout deal in Brussels on Wednesday, but many are worried that it may not rescue the country from its problems. For NPR News, I'm Joanna Kakissis in Athens.
The U.S. economy is improving, even though Americans keep having to look over their shoulders at Europe. The state of the economy affects everything in American politics right now, from the presidential election to the budget that the White House lays out today. NPR's Cokie Roberts has some analysis, as she does most Mondays. Cokie, good morning.
Hi, Steve.
Okay, so what does the president's budget tell us?
Well, it tells us what his priorities are, because we know that there's not likely to be a budget passed in Congress this year. There's not likely to be much of anything passed in Congress this year. But the president is going to Northern Virginia Community College to announce his budget. That's no accident, because he says that it is it shows that he wants to invest in community colleges and job training. And what Republicans would call spending, he calls investments in transportation infrastructure, and in research and development, but it also ends with a $1.3 trillion deficit. But he says that it's going down. It'll be $4 trillion in deficit reduction over 10 years, and he'll get to that number by ending the Bush-era tax cuts for those making more than $250,000 and limiting deductions for high earners, that so-called Buffett rule, where there would be a minimum rate of 30% of taxes for millionaires. And look, Steve, this, you know, budgets are always political documents as well as economic ones. And these are all things that are polling well. Even among Republicans, a majority says that millionaires should be paying higher taxes. So I think the president is looking at this as something to take on the campaign trail rather than to take to Capitol Hill. And that this is where the Democrats wanted to be. They wanted to be in a position where they were arguing about what to spend money on rather than how much money to spend, because they think they win that argument.
Of course, if the Republicans are able to push it back into that broader question of spending or the broader question of that very large deficit you mentioned, is that helpful to Republicans?
Well, they're certainly going to try it, and they spent all day yesterday doing that, reminding people that Obama said in 2009 that he would bring the $1.4 trillion deficit that he inherited. He would cut it in half by the end of his first term. And, of course, he hasn't done that. But, you know, deficits don't work that well as a campaign issue. Jack Kemp, the longtime Republican lawmaker and sometimes presidential candidate, used to say that there were Old Testament Republicans and New Testament Republicans, meaning that those who were preaching a happier gospel of the New Testament did better, and those who were warning of the fire and brimstone of the Old Testament didn't do so well, and that's what screaming about the deficit often comes across as. Now, it did work in the congressional campaigns of 2010, where the Tea Party did so well using the deficit. But it was more a metaphor than a reality there, more talking about the economy as a whole and feeling like Washington was out of touch. I think the deficit as an abstract idea is not a terribly useful campaign tool.
Well, what about the Republicans who want to replace President Obama? Mitt Romney, of course, managed to win narrowly caucuses in Maine after losing some big contests to Rick Santorum a few days before that.
Well, he had to win something after the Santorum sweep last Tuesday. And Maine, where a few thousand people, and I mean a few thousand people, voted, about 5,000, he pulled out by a couple of hundred votes over Ron Paul. And he also won the straw poll at the Conservative Political Action Conference that was meeting here all over the weekend. Rick Santorum, who came in second in that straw poll, implies that Romney essentially bought it. And Sarah Palin, who really wowed everybody at that conference, said that the party is still not convinced on Romney, not seeing Romney get over the hump, she said. We are not convinced. And that is the problem that he is still having inside the party. Now, he's got to get something going between now and the end of this month when there's the Michigan and Arizona primaries. Uh-huh. And he's got to do something more to convince the Republicans.
Cokie, thanks very much. That's NPR's Cokie Roberts, who joins us with analysis most Monday mornings. You hear her right here on Morning Edition from NPR News.